This is We Are What We Overcome. What you're about to hear are the ramblings and reflections of three ordinary people, drawing on their own personal and occasionally professional experiences. These conversations are unprepared, subjective, and should not be taken as medical advice or instruction. Anyone seeking help should always carry out their own research, or better yet, speak to a professional about their circumstances.
So do you want to do the introduction?
I guess I could. Where are we? Other than like the city. I'm aware of the city's name.
This is called
Edinburgh. Oh, this is nice. We're under a giant plastic tent.
We Are What We Overcome on this occasion features musician Matt McGuinness, improviser Nick Tyler, and psychotherapist Wes Evans. Sit back, enjoy, and remember, it's good to talk.
Let's go then.
All right, cool. Well, hi guys. Welcome to the We Are Overcome podcast. We talk about mental health and about how important it is to talk to people about stuff like, you know, the inside of your head. This is a very special occasion. We are underneath a plastic tent outside the Symposium Hall in Edinburgh.
In the wind.
In the wind, of course, is Edinburgh.
And the sunshine.
Ah, I know, it's amazing.
In the Surgeon's Quarter.
Ah, is that where we are?
That's where we are.
It's a city of 84 quarters, as far as I can tell, yeah, which is always exciting. I've been to some of them so far today.
I just worked it out, that's 21.
That's still too many.
We always do introductions, don't we?
We do.
How we are. That's what we do to start off with, like, who you are, how you're feeling. Like,
I think,
in about 30 seconds. Your life. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first, maybe as an example. We think like the check-in is kind of important to, for a degree of honesty and letting us know where we are with each other. Hi, I'm Nick. I'm an improviser and other stuff from Nottingham.
That's a lot of applause.
Thank you very much.
Hey.
Yep, I don't have a show here, but I guess based on that, I could.
I should have brought my crowd.
I am all right. I've come up to the Fringe just to do, mostly just to do this. And I thought I could come up to the Fringe and go and do like loads of cool things and go and see a load of shows. And I've realised while here that I didn't want to do that at all. I've seen about four shows and I've spent most of the time in charity shops walking around on my own. And it's been really good. I've really enjoyed it. It's been a very cathartic break from my day-to-day reality. I felt quite lonely, but I've been entirely focused on just the walking and doing things. And it's been great, so I'm in a really good place.
Good.
How about you, Matt?
I'm good today. A couple of days ago, I wasn't that great, because I think it was that sort of dip when you're here for 3 weeks, and then it's like, yeah, it's Hollywood! Hollywood, everybody be famous! And then you get over the other side, and then you think, oh no, people get killed in Hollywood, don't they, on the street and stuff. It's that sort of contrast. But nice bottle sound there, I like that. I'm all right. And do you know, one of the saving graces, actually, I haven't been seen at many shows, and we can nicely lead on to yours, is the only time I've really escaped from all that stuff is in other people's shows, where I've had, like, it's almost like an asylum or sanctuary, you know, where I can go somewhere and for 50 minutes I can forget about Arts Council grants and my own show and how many people come in and missing my wife and kids and just enjoy the show. So thanks very much.
Yeah.
I think you should go next after that.
Okay, my name is Ewan Martin. I'm the writer of Manshed, which is one of the shows we'll be talking about today. I'm in a pretty good place as well. I've had a couple of days off. I went back up home to escape the madness of the Edinburgh Fringe, and I was looking after my granddaughter for a couple of days, which was really good. That's grounding, but probably more exhausting than my time here in Edinburgh.
I noticed how you moved your mouth towards the microphone and said it louder, and you said granddaughter.
Granddaughter.
Yeah.
Very proud.
Very, very proud. I'll show you the photographs later. I'm in a pretty good place today because I didn't go into the show today because I've seen it several times. I think he's got it now.
You're done with it now.
Ron knows what he's doing. So
I'd like to thank you for your support. I shall wear it always.
But a really nice thing today was five people turned up from my hometown, friends. Yeah, came there. I didn't know they were coming. And they were there and they were very supportive and saw them afterwards and they loved the show. And that was great, so that made me feel really good.
Is that why you ended up in the pub afterwards and you're slightly late?
Of course.
I think you find that's my fault.
Well done.
So, I'll hand over to Ron Emsley.
Oh, hiya. My name is Ron Emsley. I'm the... Well, Manshed that Ewan was talking about, that's a one-person play. And I'm the one person. So it's really Man Shed. It's a play about a man and a shed.
That's what it says in the tin.
That's what it says. And we have one of those. That's me. We couldn't quite get the shed into the set, you know. But it's great. We're enjoying the festival. It's going very well. People are liking it a lot, which is great. And we're getting audiences, which is also great because it's whatever the press might tell you, it's actually quite quiet here this year. A lot of people are struggling.
It is quiet, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And the rail strike, God bless you guys, hasn't really helped much at all. So it's been tough for a lot of people, but we're doing okay. We're doing fine. Good reviews, which is great. And talking to a lot of people about it, you know, which is even better. You know, I mean, the audience do stick around afterwards, and when we go to the pub, we sit in the bar in the courtyard at the Pleasance. And we'll talk to people if they want to come up and have a chat. We'll do that. We had lots of the men's shed movement guys around. I mean, there must have been 20 or 30 in to see it already, I think, you know, from different sheds around the country, you know, around Scotland.
Is anyone bringing their shed with them?
Sorry?
That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
With a shed. Sign on it.
That's heckling.
Do you know what?
Call that a shed.
Your show was one of those ones I got lost in, which I was really grateful for. Actually, came at exactly the right time.
Oh, great. Yeah. That is good.
And I loved it. And it's just, you know, you just, regardless of the writing, obviously, it's not as good as you.
Stunning. The writing is stunning. Ewan's writing has been stunning for, well, we've worked together for the best part of 18 years.
18, 20 years.
Off and on, you know. But I mean, I must have done 7 tours now for Ewan and Dave and Right Lines Productions over the years, and one of them we've toured 3 times, I think, if not 4. And it's an absolute delight, you know. And the great thing for an actor is, because it's a one-person show, at least this one is, I get a fair amount of input into what's actually in the script, finally, you know, which is normally, that doesn't happen. You're handed the script and you're stuck with it, even if you don't think it's accurate or whatever, you it's there. So it's nice to be part of the team, if you like.
I'm not going to go into it because we don't want to be one of those naff reviews where they give away the whole plot line.
No.
But for me...
I mention the shed?
There isn't a shed in it, there is it. So that's the...
There's the inside of a shed.
The room is a shed.
That door on the left is a bit of a shed, isn't it? But do you know, for me, it was like... It was like I got a description of a thought that was running through your head. But like, you know, the whole picture, because when you think of thought yourself, you get the whole, not only the language, but you get the whole scenery and everything, people involved. And to me, that's what it was like. It was like you just explaining this massive thought that comes to your head about different characters in your life.
Yeah, it's kind of like a stream of consciousness thing, isn't it?
Yes, but it's also about the contradiction, the guilt. I mean, we were talking earlier, before we started recording, about one of the things about bereavement. That people don't expect is guilt, you know, especially when you've done nothing wrong, you know. But if it's not that kind of guilt, it's not about a guilt of, you know, it's partially a survivor's guilt to an extent. That's there, but there's other guilt because you remember things wrong. You remember things you said and you take them out of context and you amplify them, and you know, and you're not in control of that.
Yeah.
It's not a conscious thing at all. And the, I mean, in the play, without giving too much away, there's a guilt between his wife who's passed away 5 years earlier, and he's got his best friend who's passed away in the last month or two. Yeah, and it's like he didn't even like his friend very much. You know, they fought, they bickered, they argued all the time. He loved his wife with every breath in his body, but he probably misses his friend more on a day-to-day basis, and that's weird. And it's wrong. It feels wrong.
It made me think about my mum and dad, because my dad wasn't my biological father, and he died about, I don't know, 3 years ago maybe. My mum died about 25 years ago. And so you think that, you know, with my mum I'd have more of a, you know. But actually, I don't know if it's because of my age or the proximity to it. It's my dad's death that I think about a lot, you know.
Yeah,
which is... You talk about that. What about
that? Well, it's strange. It's the lack of control that you have over it. But we always think that if you want to treat mental health, you need to sort of somehow take control of it. But you're not in control of your own mind. The same way you're not really in control of your body. Most of it's just doing stuff, and you're also there, which is horrible because it dissociates us from our identity, from our bodies, because we don't have the ability to go, oh, I'm going to stop feeling sad now. And it's so hard to do that. And It's one of the things that I like about both your show, Matt, and about Manshed, is it's about partly about distraction.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I find that fascinating, that the more you dwell on something, the worse it gets. You know, the way to resolution isn't always through thinking about things a lot. I quite like walking around, as I say, I like walking around Edinburgh, and it's kind of cleared my brain. I haven't been thinking about anything in particular. It's just deleted everything with every step. So I'm going to go home with broken feet, but you know, a somewhat cleansed mind. And part of that is just by being attracted by sheer activity. Sometimes the activity of talking to people and just, you know, having a chat and being immersed in someone else's problems, someone else's interests. Because, you know, much though I'd love to steer it all back onto Transformers or whatever nonsense I think about all the time, being involved in expressing empathy for someone else's issues is a great way to retrain your own brain. By showing interest in someone else, you can become interested in yourself once
more. The idea of actually feeling empathy for somebody because of the change in your situation, because you're now experiencing something that they've experienced or they are experiencing. You know, you wouldn't have had empathy for that because you wouldn't have known what it felt like. You wouldn't have understood what they were going through or whatever. The weirdest one for me is that everything comes in waves. You know, you're talking about control and distraction. For me, on my personal thing, it's not in the show as such, but it is that it just hits me in waves and it comes out of nowhere. Mm. And then, you know, suddenly, I remember a couple of months back going in for a vitamin B shot or something like that, a flu jab. Going in for a flu jab. And they had to call the doctors in. It was just the nurse giving me an injection. And I ended up like a soggy puddle on the floor. And then 2 minutes later, I'm absolutely fine.
Mm.
You know, and you're not, it's just that, it's a lack of control. You know, it happens to me all the time through the day. You know, I'll just suddenly go. And then you learn to just let it go. And then you're back.
It's scary, isn't it? It's an aspect of trauma. You know, when we experience these deeply emotional, you know, emotional events, whether it's, you know, bereavement or abuse or something, you know, the mark that it leaves in you is something you have no control over, and it just rips itself open. What I've always found is the thing that ultimately sort of controls it is reliving it. You know, every time it comes back up again, you're reliving that. You're re-experiencing that set of memories, and the emotions for me slowly fade. I'm re-experiencing, thrown back into trauma, and I can see everything that happened again. And because this is 30 years on, it's all, I guess, it hurts less. I'm seeing it differently, and what I'm really remembering is the last time that I remembered it, not what happened. It's that, the remembering the memory, and it's
disassociated from the actual event.
So you're like watching it as opposed to experiencing it?
Kind of, yeah. So it's not that it doesn't matter anymore, because yeah, the past always matters, and the past is the only thing that's real anyway, which is one of my huge bugbears. Yeah, the future's nonsense.
You don't have a clue what's happened in the
future. No, it's all lies and horrifying and terrifying, isn't it? The past is all you can rely on. But worse, the past is only what you think you can remember, and all your memories are lies anyway. Because they're all false. They're all little concoctions of hints and memories. No one remembers the conversation fully. You remember the bit that you think you remembered, and if you're feeling sad at the time, that will also bend it out of truth. As you know, you're saying the things that I thought I said or thought I didn't say. Maybe you did. Maybe you didn't. Doesn't matter. The only truth of it is what's now sitting in your head. And the next time you remember it again, it will alter slightly. And over time, really it might become a good memory, or might become a much worse memory. You still don't have any control over it.
I'm of an age where my memory is getting poorer and poorer, so I can't remember situations that, you know, there was conflict. I can't remember every single detail, and that kind of leaves me a little bit shortchanged in terms of trying to remember serious events in my life, because I can't. So I just try and drift on, move on gently.
I wonder,
to the good bits.
That feels almost like a gift. I realise that might sound quite odd. There's a whole bunch of stuff that I would love to forget completely. And that
the 80s.
Yeah. That's where all the good stuff was.
We're in the early 70s.
But there's something odd about identity in that, though, that, you know, really we're only composed of memories. If we lose those memories, what have we got left? That somehow there's a personality that runs on some background set of
memories that we think we've got somewhere. It's very confusing about who we really are.
Sorry, Ron, I was going to say there's a line in the show where we deal with dementia and that kind of thing is part of the show. And there's a line in the show where it says, memory, that's what makes us human. Mm. So what happens when you start to lose your memory? What happens? Does that make you any less human?
Mm.
And the character says, no, he's talking about his friend Alec, and he says, no, Alec was always just Alec. Mm. He didn't become any less human. He was always my mate. And
I've never had a good memory. One thing my wife detests, because we could have this massive argument. 2 minutes later, I'm happy as Larry and we're fine. Can't remember any of it.
Yeah, that's great. That's the best.
For like 2 days.
Hugely irritating, I think, is what some would say.
I mean, that's the best way to deal with it.
Memory is massively selective anyway, you know. An example from another piece of theatre, I mean, about 10, 11 years ago, I did Death of a Salesman, playing Willie Loman, and I remember having an argument with a journalist who'd written a very nice review, but had gone on about the flashbacks in the play. You know, when it flashbacks to when Willie's with his boys when they're at high school, that sort of age, and of course now they're in their 30s and moved on. And he was saying, oh, the flashbacks are great. I said, they're not flashbacks. If you look at them, they're memories, and he remembers it wrong.
Mm.
You know, because his son remembers it differently. The son of his friend, the next door neighbour, remembers it differently from both of them. Mm. You know, they all have their own little viewpoint on that snatch of history, but they don't remember. And Willie's keeps changing.
Yeah.
As he gets more and more tired in the play, his memory shifts, it changes, and you know, whatever. And that's the complication that a lot of us have with our families and stuff about. You know, when I have with my brother, you know, remembers stuff that happened when we were a kid. And I'm going, no, I was there. That never happened. And he went, yes, it did happen. I did memory regression. Oh, well done, you. You know, it's just like...
I have the same problem. My little brother becomes a perfect memory of our childhood.
He won't speak to other members of the family because of something he thinks happened the best part of 50 years ago.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it's insane, but it's not. It's so natural and human. I think, you know.
It's deeply human to create our own stories.
Oh,
and
yeah, yeah.
You sanitize it as well, don't you?
I think you do. It's self-protection.
Clean your memories.
Mm. Yeah, you ideally want to clear out the bad stuff and keep I had a wonderful orange-tinged childhood where everything was beautiful and lovely. That sounds much better. It's weird that it's then a lie. Yeah, and then we become a heap of lies that nonetheless makes us happy. Is that bad?
But then you go to the other side of that same coin. You know, where people are remembering things that aren't happy, that are tragic, you know, and whatever. And are you questioning those in the same way that you question the happy memories? It's a very individual thing, I think.
It leaves us in a very strange place as creatures that believe that we run on these memories.
I think we can spend too long in our heads.
Hence distraction.
Yes.
You're just going to do something else, you know. I think it gives your brain a chance to work stuff out or to forget it. Or to reframe it, as you're saying, you know, to re-sanitize something that's better.
I mean, we've got another line from the play which is about exactly that. He's talking about, you know, a lot of people hate being on their own and hate their own company, and he's saying, you know, people say you should get, you know, keep yourself active.
Fill your day,
and he says, and I do, I do. But there are 24 hours in every single day, and that's a lot of time to fill with distraction.
Yeah. Yep. There's only so many thousand-piece jigsaws you can complete in that time.
Yeah. So many briquettes you can make, which is part of the show.
What's the conversations like afterwards? With people who've been there?
With people?
Yes.
Very positive. We have had what they call shedders. We have had a number of shedders, guys that actually attend men's sheds. Mm. And they've come in to see the show, which is absolutely great.
Yeah.
And a number of them have come out and come up to us afterwards and said that, you know, and they're patting their heart. And so that really touched the nerve. And, you know, a lot of them have had loss in their lives. You know, a guy said to me, I lost my wife last November, you know, and you hit every mark, you know, in terms of his grief process and how he's trying to come out of that. So that's great.
That element's great, isn't it? You know, we have it with the show where people come up, and I had this one night where there was like two or three people who all have lost their other half. to suicide. And they came because they wanted to hear what a male view of mental health. And so that's the view you're talking about hearing, you know, you go through the story. So it just gives them a chance to not feel... You know that thing, didn't you, about... You get to the point where you realise it's really boring because loads of people think like this. You're not very that original.
Oh, it's so disappointing, isn't it? You know, we're not special remotely. It's like, surely I'm the only one that feels like this.
Yeah.
And yet then you have that empathic experience.
But you are. Mm. You are, because, I mean, the story we're telling them, which is freeing up their head to examine their situation, it's not their story, you know. But it's allowing them to look at their own story in a way, in a gentle way, if you like. You know, which is, it's not just me, but we're not saying this is the answer to everything. But
a lot of people have been deeply affected by our shows. You know, they've come out, you know, moved to tears, and they're quite literally, and can't speak when they come out.
It's good when that happens, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little bit of you going, yeah, that's great.
I've affected you.
I broke your heart.
I'm so sorry.
Want to write a show that
it's all right, I'm a doctor, I can fix it. What a matter.
To upset you, but in a sense, if you make that connection with people, and yes, of course, everybody goes to see something and they relate it back to themselves and their own experience. And if it's touched a nerve because it's something is raw or something is fresh for them, or it's been a bereavement or a loss or whatever, I don't think that's a bad thing.
I think
it's a great
outcome. To be able to have an emotional experience is very important. It's very easy with trauma and grief to end up retreating into a sort of grey state where nothing gets in, where you're not connecting with yourself emotionally, you're not expressing yourself. Yeah. I think that's much more dangerous. I think at that point, you're probably not really human anymore because you don't have any feelings. They're all locked and you're locked down.
You're locking it in,
You can't communicate and deal. It's
one
horrible.
Of the best things that I've put on in terms of the research I spoke to the chief executive officer of the Scottish Men's Sheds Association, a guy called Jason Schroeder, and he said, like, it takes a long time it takes a long time for men's sheds to be set up, something between 1 and 5 years before they actually go through all the process of setting up. And then to get men to come along to sheds, equally similar length of time, because guys come along, they show a little bit of interest, a bit like the character in the plays. It's easier to be negative and keep myself to myself. I'm not going to bother. That's for other people. That's a lot of nonsense. I'm not really getting into that. And then they maybe come along and they have a new trial session. And then what happens, the main ethos of the men's shed movement is that women talk to each other face to face, and they get involved in lots of like book groups and slag me off for this, but knitting bees and all that kind of stuff, and they're very good at speaking face to face like this. Men don't do that. They don't talk about their feelings or their problems, but give them something to do, give them a project, a task, and they'll stand shoulder to shoulder with each other. They'll look straight ahead or they'll concentrate on the task in front of them. And then they'll start to talk about the wee health issue that they've had, and their mate will maybe say, "I've had something like that. Maybe you should go along and see your doctor." You know, and it's that I think that was one of the best things I ever heard from this guy Jason. That's how men start to talk about their issues and their problems, and they start to open up because they've got a project, they've got a focus, they've got a set of tools in their hands that they can work with.
That we're only good with literal metaphors.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the greatest benefits of the men's shed movement.
Sounds like a wonderful project.
About, they're engaged socially, they're starting to discuss the issues that they may, and some of them don't have issues in their life, but a lot of them really, really do. And that's the way they start to open up, because they've got a task. They've got to build that birdhouse, and they've got to make that bench, you know what I mean? So that's a great thing about the men's shed.
No, I think that's lovely. It sounds like an immensely valuable project.
I think it is. It started in Australia with the military, with Australian ex-military, because they don't have, or at least according to Jason, I think, if I understood him correctly, they didn't have that same sort of backup that we now tend to have here. And even over here, it's not ideal. You know, there's still so many people with PTSD you know, falling through the cracks and all the rest of it. But that's what, that's how it started, was to try and get these men to socialise, you know, and they, which they just weren't doing because they'd never had any history of it. They were part of a team, a little unit, or a company, or whatever, or people who weren't in the military would be at work, and they'd worked with the same guys for the last 20 years or 30 years. And then you retire, and they've taken away all your friends. You know,
and the structure,
and the routine. Yeah, getting up in the morning. You know, and all that's there to replace it is either the golf course, which is fine, or the pub, you know, which is also fine, but not 24 hours a day. You know? So it's
23,
it's, it's having to find that place
you
where
you pub, not the golf course.
The pub. <for clarity. laughs> The way I play 24 hours a day, that's a round.
It's funny, though, that they need to reach out and not just to hide away. It's as you're saying earlier, it can be so hard to just ask for help.
But it's so unnatural. It's just, it goes against everything. I think
we're trained really badly, aren't we, for this sort of stuff?
We're trained to be stoic. We're trained to be, you know, self-reliant. You know, yes,
it's all about resilience. You know, and you've got to be there for your
inner strength, and
your,
you know.
Can we just quickly, how much time we've got left, but could we quickly talk about the Fringe itself and and ourselves? Because I think one of the things that keeps getting missed sometimes is the fact that we all come here, we come here for 3.5 weeks, we're going to do this. It's like,
I'm bankrupt.
And then you sort of fall off a cliff about 10 days in or something, and you think, oh my God, it's Groundhog Day again.
Well, yeah, for you two particularly, you're both doing one-man shows, which is grueling emotional and physical work.
By the end of the week, I mean, my hardest day last week was Sunday. That's my, because I had Monday off, and I could hardly focus. I could hardly walk on the Sunday. Got through the show. Wasn't really sure I was going to, but it did. And then spent a holiday, the whole day Sunday, just sitting down in front of my PlayStation, you know, watching television on it, you know. But it is, especially a one-man show, is emotionally grueling, mentally grueling, because you're not sharing that burden with somebody else on stage. It's just, you know, it's all on you. You know, so
and you're presenting a show that's really quite emotional and raw.
Well, we both are, you know. So it's we're both dealing with issues that we're not that far away from. You know, so you know, there's a lot of personal content in there.
I got on my day off, there was a meet the press thing in some basement somewhere over the side, and so I thought I better go to this. This is my day off, first day off. So I got up early, went there, it was in the basement, it was really hot, you know, it was packed. And I got there, I got myself a glass of water and thought, I can't do this, and just walked straight out.
Did you?
Yeah,
right.
Just too much for now.
Yeah.
Just, and I think that's the thing, I just thought, when I walked out, I thought, just go and do something else, you know, do something nothing to do with the Fringe, and go and, I don't know what, go to the pub.
Vintage Clue.
Doing a lot of that. Sit in restaurants. I love sitting in restaurants, you know, on my own, you know, spending way too much money on very expensive, irrelevant food, you know, but it just takes your mind away from everything, you know, and you're not just getting completely wasted, you know.
How do you guys deal with the expectations, you know, putting a show on is, you know, we've all done various forms of theatre, and there's a lot of expectation and build up and preparation.
Oh,
but that's hard to work with as well. Like, you know, go, well, I'm going to do a thing, it'll be all right, is maybe even harder than having high hopes.
Well,
that's tough.
You may have noticed, but we're gentlemen of advanced years, so we're not fresh young things.
The run looks devastated by this.
Expecting to make our fortunes at the Fringe because our show is the best. Nobody's seen such a show. No, we've been around the block a bit. And,
we know what it could be like. And I mean, one of the nice things this year is I'm not seeing the doom and gloom that I often see at the end of the second week, when people realise that they're not going to get another car this year. They're not, you know, they'll be lucky if they can pay their rent next month.
The current car's going to be.
They've just lost an absolute bloody fortune, and their ambition has been crushed. You know, all of that hope is gone. You know, they're still out there banging away. You know, trying away, which I think is great.
I mean, it's a couple of weeks without paying energy bills. That's a win.
Yeah, I've got two children, and I pay their energy bills.
Oh, no.
As well as mine. I felt bad. I think came out from the Green Party about, or was it Greenpeace, about pledging to drive less in August. So I nearly signed it, said I'm not going to drive at all in August.
Look at me.
I'm going to get the train
totally
everywhere.
So strong.
Yeah. Taking the bus everywhere.
That's strange. Oh. Well, it sounds like you guys are having a good run, which is really great.
Yeah, it's
it would have been lovely if we'd been full all the time. That is never going to happen. It's not happened to a lot of people. There are a lot of shows here that are just really doing. They're playing to four people and, you know, five people or whatever. So yeah, we're happy with that. And in terms of what we'll get out of this, what we will get out of this, is we're not going to break even, I don't think, are you? So,
it's the
launch pad for the tour in the spring. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got reviews to do it. We've got a film that we can show people, or put a little trailer together and send that out. So this will launch a much better, bigger tour in the spring, and that will be great.
That sounds like a great.
And also, I think the thing we can't forget about is what it does to ourselves as well. You know, it's genuinely is a good experience, isn't it? You know, I mean, I feel great about it.
I'm out of the house.
Yeah.
You know, and reminding myself of who I used to be. You know, I retired over 10 years ago, so it's just like this is reminding myself who I used to be, and like most people's jobs, your personality is tied up in who you are, what you do. You know, in a lot of things, not just performing or, you know, acting, singing. Whatever, you know.
We keep interrupting Ron's retirement. He was very happy to not be doing any theatre work and keep sending them scripts and saying, "Would you like to do this? We've got a little tour planned for the north of Scotland."
I keep saying that,
yes.
I didn't leave the house for 6 months. I had no plans to leave the house, as it happens.
That sounds great. I think one of the best things about both your shows in Manchester and Wheel of Cameras, they're emotionally impactful shows. So never mind what it is that you're taking away from those performers. Yeah, no one's leaving either of these shows unaffected. And the least we can hope for from art is to affect people. And the best we can hope for from mental health conversations is to affect people and help people think and feel.
Definitely in both shows. I mean, there's an awful lot of food for thought in there. There's a lot of information being given out, and people are going out thinking. Not just crying or feeling involved or whatever, but they're thinking.
Yeah.
You know, not just about themselves, but you know, relatives they know, friends they know, whatever. You know, the man two doors down, you know.
That seems like a lovely thought to end this on, really.
Yeah.
That we're ultimately reaching a point of empathy for others and helping people open up.
The lovely thought to end on is that a woman came up to us yesterday, both of us, myself and Ron, after the show, and said, "I've been coming to the Fringe for 20 years and that's the best show I've seen."
Yes,
oh, she did.
That'll do
she
nicely.
Did say that.
Yeah. That's great.
And it wasn't my wife, it wasn't anybody I'm related to.
She's clearly not seen my show.
I didn't pay her.
I think that there's a lot of stuff out there this year that's been well thought through. We've had a lot of time to actually during the lockdown to sit back and look at these shows that we've got and stuff, you know, and hone them and refine them and do all that. And I think that's evident everywhere this year. There's a lot more thought gone into it than just putting an hour together so I can go to Edinburgh, you know, as some sort of comic rite of passage, you know.
Yeah. Do you know, one last thought, I think, because we're going to do tour it, you're going to tour yours, we should try and meet up in 12 or 18 months' time and look back and see what
happens. See where we are.
Yeah, yeah. See if we're still smiling there.
We'll be in Hollywood.
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 did that come out wrong? Yeah. Hollywood.
We'll compare medication.
Cool. Thanks for today. It's been great. Oh, thanks.
No, thank you.
Thanks,
it's been lovely.
That was a great conversation.
Thanks, Ron.
Take care, guys. If you've been affected by anything that we've talked about tonight, that's cool. We were kind of hoping you would be. If you haven't been affected by anything tonight, then that's great too. You're probably fine. Of course, if you say you're fine, there's a good chance you aren't. So you might also have been affected. And if you've been affected before, you probably will be again. Please talk to someone. It can get better, and together we can survive. We are what we overcome. This poor little boy, grounded by the sun, paler by his side.